Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome back, everybody. It's great after a couple of weeks hiatus to be back in front of the microphone with my esteemed and ever genial co-host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate everybody taking time to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are interested, and if you're with us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where you will find a link to the chat room. And you can hop on in there with some of the usual suspects. Paul is standing athwart the quarterdeck, as usual. Glad to see you again, Paul. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or you just have some questions you would like for us to direct to our guest during the course of the next hour, that is a great place to do it. It's also helpful that if you have to run off and catch up with other work in your life and you want to see what you missed on the part of the show you had to walk away from, if you don't already, you can catch the remainder of that show and all Midrats simply by going over to iTunes, Spreaker, or any of the other podcast aggregators and go ahead and sign up for the podcast. And that way, Midrats will be waiting for you at a time of your convenience. And, of course, there is no time that is not convenient to talk about our fleet and force levels. And that's what we're going to do today, kind of like we put in the pre-show, is we're going to look back a little bit at our predictability and how we perform on that. But we're also going to look at, based upon the 23 shipbuilding plan, that latest data point we have, what we are looking at relative to our greatest maritime competitor as we go through the 2020s and looking a little bit at the 2030s as well. And our guest to discuss this really needs no introduction to regular Midrats listeners. He's a regular guest during the course of the years and even has jumped in as an occasional guest co-host, Matthew Hipple. He is an active duty surface warfare officer and former president of the Center for International Maritime Security. Matthew is here today on his own accord, and his opinion is strictly that of himself and is not necessarily that of the United States Navy or any other organizations he may be associated with. And for those that have access to the show page, kind of the kicking off point for today's show is Matthew's latest article that you can find over at CIMSEC titled 20 Years of Naval Trends Guarantee an FY23 Shipbuilding Plan Failure, and the link is to the article there. Matthew, as always, it's great to have you back on Midrats.
Well, thanks, guys. It's nice to be back in the podcast world. You know, now that the department head tour has been over a little bit, I find that I have slightly more free time, only slightly, you know, with my two sons now, but trying to work it in, you know, trying to get back into the flow of things. But it's nice to be able to get back into the scrum, and especially good to have these public discussions, because I think they're valuable. You know, this is what we do. This is what you guys have been doing since the beginning. This is what we built CIMSEC for, which was to kind of bring, you know, without accusations, without malice, just having a public conversation about the information that's in front of us to better inform the public, better inform ourselves, and just have a good time, because this is – the Navy is something that we all love. Maritime security, you know, if you're – I'm sure John's listening and he's screaming something about me not mentioning the Merchant Marine yet, so there you go. Did it. but, yeah, you know, Matthew, it's what we're all here for, and I love to take part in.
And I think that, you know, you mentioned CIMSEC. I remember when you kiddies were first putting that together. You know, CIMSEC, I think, represents you and the folks that have written there, something that you and I have and others have talked about for years, is there are a lot of really smart people out there irrespective of age, rank, or background, that really have some good things to contribute, some perspectives to bring to the national security conversation, especially related to maritime issues. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, a lot of them will not or do not engage in the conversation, and y'all created a great venue to bring other voices into the conversation who've brought in some really great ideas that perhaps would not have been given the opportunity to elsewhere. So wax your the apple there, the folks over at CivSec. And there are other similar publication venues out there. The more conversations, the better. And one thing I like to tell people, occasionally folks will reach out to me who are interested in contributing. I was like, if you have an idea, if you have a thought, go out there and contribute. Give it your best shot, whether you only have 10 minutes or if you're blessed with 10 hours, it can make a big difference. And the fun thing about having you on with this article is after we had already, I think after we had already communicated with it, this is a good data point for people. There's, you know, Matthew Hipple, who's got a busy personal professional life. He's got some ideas bouncing around in his brain, and they congealed for a brief moment. You put it on paper. And lo and behold, Representative Matt Walt took one of your diagrams, actually the picture that's on the show page, and you made it in the congressional record. The one thing I wanted to, before I get to a substantive question, Matthew, I wanted to ask you, are you able to get hold of that 3-foot by 5-foot poster board so you can put that on your wall somewhere, or is that lost in some staff weenie's garbage can right now?
I have no idea, but that's an amazing plan. I need to see if there's someone I could – that would be incredible, especially because he drew on it. I feel like, there you go.
Yeah.
It's the evidence. This is the one. This is the one. It was a bit of a shock. You spend 12 years writing about random stuff, you know, not because I think I'm so cool and I have so many great ideas, but because I love writing about Navy stuff. You know, I'm a huge nerd,
yeah.
and writing professionally is – a great opportunity to focus your mind and engage in a broader conversation and to see something that I made, especially a graphic. I love writing. You know, I make all these stupid memes and I make graphics and things, and you're like, oh, yes, it's a graph. A graph made it there because the committee graphs and their and the pictures that people post up are kind of like a meta meme, right? Those become popular.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, what picture's showing up in Congress today? And for that chart to become one of them and part of an important and serious conversation. You know, politics gets ridiculous sometimes, but that 10 minutes with Representative Luria and Representative Waltz back-to-back was an intense discussion about ground truth when it comes to naval power. And, well, that was awesome. I couldn't have done it. But, you know, I wrote an article. I made the chart, and I thought that Representative Waltz just hit a home run, pounding that chart into the ground and making the points that he made. And then to just sweep the floor then with Representative Luria going even deeper into the data and the detail. When we talk about congressional oversight, you know, it's my Navy, it's my institution. We're taking direct hits, and if those hits are to be had, we should be taking them. And we need to justify ourselves. And that's what I love seeing Congress do, is just doing that serious work and getting into it with the institutions that they're supposed to hold accountable.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that's something, again, that we've talked about over the years. And I know my co-host and I have asked a lot of guests, you know, who in Congress. And it's been just in the last few recent years, now, there's this mystical era that may have never existed called bipartisan consensus. And I think, you know, you got Representative Luria, you have Representative Walt, you also have Representative Gallagher, Senator Tom Cotton, and there are other people in Congress in both parties who are really starting to engage. And I think that that friction and that pressure on our Navy is good. If it makes it perform better, that's better for all of us. But anyway, that was just that was a great thing to see, Matthew, and I hope that encourages other people that, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. You didn't start writing last week. You've been at this for a while, and it should encourage other people to put on their thinking hats and step out there and start writing. But you know, what was neat about it too, and here's, I'm finally getting around to my open question. I can feel Mark's eyeballs looking at me like, you know, I'd like to ask a question to show too. But here we are. Most people in the national security arena are focused on the largest ground combat operations in Europe since World War II, the Russia-Ukrainian war. And that has a little bit of nautical stuff that maybe we can talk about later on in the show. But in the midst of all that, you pushed this out and it actually got traction. But talk for a little bit about, with all that other stuff going in the world, where you said, you know what, I want to go talk about what's happening in Washington, D.C., in our shipyards, facing the threat west of Wake in the Pacific.
Well, I had the article come out with Mike about congressional oversight. And within a few days of that article coming out, the shipyard plan that everybody had been screaming for came into existence suddenly. Like, oh, it's here. It's finally here. And that small moment of celebration. And because I'm a naval officer obsessed with my own institution, of course, I went down that rabbit hole. It wasn't some, you know, special, like, oh, man, wouldn't this be a neat take? It was just, hey, man, this is my jam. This is my profession. This is what I'm interested in. But when I read it, and I read some of the commentary online that was critical of it, I realized I didn't know enough information to say whether this was, like, okay, let's say on its face it's not good. That's my personal opinion. But is it an improvement? And I realized I had no idea whether this was a trend line up, a trend line down. I didn't know the history of the shipbuilding plans. Like, maybe I read them offhand, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, but I don't remember any of that data. So to make sure that I didn't sound like an idiot in my perspective on the shipbuilding plan, I went back to the last one, and then I went back to the last one. And then thanks to Sam Legrone's database at USNI News of all these shipbuilding plans, I just, from mild OCD, kept digging into the shipbuilding plans, thinking like, wait a minute, where have we been? Where have we gone? And what is the message there? What are we learning from these data points? And that's where eventually, after screwing around with Excel, building different charts, looking at different pieces of information in different ways, I ultimately came up with that crabbing concept, where I looked at the 5 years back and saw, oh, that's so weird how it follows, looking 5 years back, the past 5 years follows that trend line. This is like, oh, man, this is like a sea and anchor detail. Like, we're going down a channel and we're aiming the numbers up, but we're never reaching it, but we are pushing that pressure there. So I dug into the CRS reports from Ron O'Rourke, who is a national treasure, all the way back to 2013. There was a report from CRS in 2013 that I just happened to find that discussed from that year back until about the QDR what the Navy's nominal goals were. And that's where the chart that showed up Congressman Waltz came to be was, you know, none of this is some cool amount of research that I conducted. I just found the research that other people had done. And, you know, in the words of Jurassic Park, I've stood on the shoulders of giants, and then I'm selling it. If you haven't seen Jurassic Park, go see it, please. That's a great reference if you don't know what it is. And that's it, right? I just went looking to relieve my own ignorance. And the only reason a chart came about was because there's about a decade of shipbuilding plans. And I'm looking at the numbers and thinking, my brain's not smart enough to start visualizing this. So let me put it in a chart. And when it showed up in a chart, you saw gradually everything shift up. And then fiscal year 23, just collapse. And that was the core of the article, is realizing what all these trends meant, what all the failures to meet our old nominal goals meant. And it's that quote about 300 ships I just came upon in chance. I was looking through the different plans, and I was like, oh, is this a shipbuilding? Like, which one is this? Do these all match? And literally thinking, am I familiar enough with the documentation to know what it is that I'm looking at? Are these different kinds of documents? Do they count things in different ways? And I was scrolling through, reading the SECNAV's introductory letter to the FY14 plan, and saw that line about 300 ships. Then I went out into my family room, had a good scream, and then came back in and finished all of my charts. And I was realizing that since we haven't even met the goal that we imagined, and that's, you know, that's the quote at the beginning of the article, we haven't met the goal to fight the 2018 version of our adversaries. And we're still struggling. Now we're talking about a ship decrease. You know, I know that I am not the man in the arena. Sometimes I am, you know, struggling with LCS stuff. I know you're an LCS hater. I'm an LCS man. We can still find this peaceable ground to meet on. But in this case, you know, I'm not at OpNav. I'm not working with Congress. I'm not moving all these numbers. I don't have green eye shade. Mine's an amateur one. I'm the critic here. You know, people are doing hard work. They're trying. They didn't just build the shipbuilding plan as a joke. A lot of hard work went into building this product and finding this direction. I recognize, you know, I'm the critic here. But I do think that there's issues with the plan, right? I'm just the lookout. The OD, the JOD, QMC are all doing their hard work on the bridge. Hey, man, I just see a light on the horizon, and I think maybe we'll run into it. And that's what my article is here.
Well, I think your article is timely in the sense that I'm one of those people that believes every organization needs someone to warn them if they're headed into shoal water. And as I look back on the history of that, you've captured a lot of it very well, but I'll just take your I'm going to pick on the crack LCS program for a minute, because somebody along the way, in my view, should have been saying, whispering in someone's ear, are we really going to do this? Do we need that capacity? Unless, you know, what happens if we don't, we haven't predicted the future, that we're not going to need to worry about sea lines of communication, you know, except regionally, and we're going to worry mostly about stuff close to, you know, inshore stuff. And what happens if we have a blue water competitor who's a regional power and has more ships than we do? And has anybody looked at Wayne Hughes' books on what happens if somebody has more weapons than you have and what the disastrous result of that is? You know, and I just go, okay, well, Matt Hipple's on the right road with this. He's got, you know, we have I think it's a statutory requirement to have 355 ships. We're nowhere close. And of the 355 ships, if you were going to count them, right now we've got, I don't know, 28 LCSs, all of which seem to be problematic, and that we've got hull cracks and transmission problems. Now, maybe they're fixable. Maybe we're going to load them up with all kinds of good stuff. I don't know. But I'm very concerned about, we have some very competent ships. I think that the DDGs are really competent ships. But we're also, as you note, getting ready to get rid of some cruisers with a lot of VLS launchers on them, and I'm really curious as to why we do that to ourselves. And I know I want to talk a little bit about this great divest to invest stuff, because I think we're leaving ourselves in a critically vulnerable position, and I think you're pointing that out, at least as far as shipbuilding, because we're not building the ships, and I don't know if we can get to that point unless we really crank up some stuff that we haven't cranked up yet. So having said that, did I hit any good buttons for you there, Matt?
Yeah, you did. I want to bring up. On Twitter, I forget who had said it, but they said, you know, hey, this seems like a really gotcha moment from Congressman Maltz, the CNO. And I don't think either one of their points was missed. You say divest to invest. We all know the way that you invest is to invest. But, you know, OpNav's walked away from that. And they've said, we're not divesting to invest. We are focusing on capability rather than capacity. And I think as a risk mitigation strategy, the CNO's point's absolutely right. You say, you know, if you can cut a margin out, build one or two more ships, is that more valuable than being loaded to the gills with SM6 and NSM and all the latest weapon systems and everybody is max readiness and just annihilating inserves left and right? That point is absolutely correct. That's what I would want if I was a CO. Like, oh, great, there's one or two more ships somewhere on Earth, but I want that good stuff to fight the fight. And, you know, 5 years is not a lot of time to do it in. But there's two issues I submit with that is the risk mitigation strategy isn't the strategy. Money exists. There is, you know, we spent 20 years with OCO and all these other emergency functions of government, all these different kinds of budget mechanisms, and we are in the position to preempt those emergency situations. If we're in one now, we're in an emergency situation, but bullets aren't flying yet. People aren't dying yet. And we can preempt that. The other part is it in the invest to invest strategy, we got to start working now. I am not as familiar with industry. One of the parts of my article I was least confident in was the chart showing the 30-year average of ship construction intentions for each shipbuilding plan going back to FY11. I'm not in industry. I'm not familiar with shipyard financing, but as a pure amateur, those numbers look very close to one another. So how do we signal to industry? And as my dad said, it's not a signal, it's a commitment. A lot of business doesn't work on signals. Some does, but when it comes to big money like that, you're looking for commitments. What kind of commitments does industry need to say, yeah, this is worth it. We're going to dump money into new yards and new capability and training new personnel? Because that's key. It has to happen now so that it exists in the future for us to use. How do we maximize the use of, you know, HII and other entities, and how do we encourage folks, Captain Bartlett at the Lordstown Lorraine project, how do we push all these things so that in the future we are not, to bring it to the Port Arthur topic we put at the title of the show, you know, in that situation where the Russians are stuck in Port Arthur, they have limited ship repair capabilities, and the Japanese are just going back to Sasebo and slapping everything back together because they do have that capability. The next war is going to be very, if it happens, it's going to be very bloody and violent, and, you know, some people question how long it'll last, but you still don't want to leave yourself without that reserve, and that's like one of Mahan's big points. Is the number of population and the character of a nation. They kind of blend together, but who do you have that can do what? What facilities exist? And what reserves are there, not just in, oh, I have extra warships, but what kind of dual-use technologies, dual-use people, dual-use functions of society can support your conflict? And, you know, that's not just sea power. That's everything. And China has a significant number of dual-use shipyards that produce a significant number of ships and are building skills with a broad worker base of folks that not only can support ships at sea but can operate upon them, you know, with a vast maritime militia. We lack a lot of that, and we certainly do have far better capabilities. But how long will that last, and how long will that capability overwhelm capacity, if we even have that relative difference? So when the CEO, you know, that exchange between Congressman Waltz and the CNO is absolutely right. Those are two very legitimate ideas that are being presented and have incredible worth. And they're both right. The question, or rather what I would pose, is that Congressman Waltz is right in looking to that next step. This is the risk mitigation strategy. How do we advocate? What do we need so it's not just risk mitigation?
You know, Matthew, you mentioned something in the pre-show conversation our guest didn't have the pleasure of listening to that I wanted to circle back to, because when you said it, my mind popped. Business plan and something in the – I don't really want to admit how long it's been since I left active duty. In the dozen-plus years since I left active duty, something I'm a little familiar with. With a business plan, you try to predict, you try to project. It's imperfect, you know, low band, high band based upon past performance, and you have to look back at what you do. And occasionally you'll be too optimistic. Sometimes you're a little pessimistic. You'll be, you know, you'll be above, you'll be below, you'll be pretty close. You're within a half standard deviation of the previous half decade's estimates, et cetera, and so forth. However, when you consistently are wrong in one direction, in your business plan or in your projections, unless there's some market externalities you weren't able to bring into your plan, it speaks to a few things. It speaks to either bad data or a bad culture or a bad business projection process, something in that area. It doesn't happen by accident. When you looked at that consistent overpromise and under-delivering, which, again, in the business world, if you do that, you get fired or you lose your customers. It's just simple as that, because you cannot plan for the future if you are constantly lying to yourself. Whether it's by lie or just the system in place, what are some of those things you think are leading that are subject to reform and change that's leading us to consistently overpromise and underdelivering, which when you do for a decade, you find yourself in kind of a pickle, which is where we are?
So where that conversation, just for the crowd, where that conversation started is I'm so much in my own head and in the Navy, I like to, you know, hand the piece over to my wife or to my dad and just say, does this make sense? So I sound like a weirdo. Is any of this relatable to the normal world? And when my dad and I were talking about the article, he's like, this is, they not do this? Like, it's just not a thing. Like, he's sort of like, I don't understand. Like, this is great, but I don't understand. Like, does data already exist? And it didn't. He's like, he was just sort of shocked at the fact there's not a year-on-year assessment of what's the current business plan? What is the projected business plan? Will we meet it? Will we fall short? Why? All the sorts of things a normal company has to do. Now, I caveat this with the business is not a military, and military is not a business. The books that I hate the most are the ones that are like, ha-ha, how to run your company like a ship. Nope, don't do that. A ship is a really bad example. Warship is a terrible example of how to run a business. And then one's like, hey, here's how to fix the military and make it run like a company. Nope, this is, you do not want to try to run a profit for the shareholders on a military. They are two institutions that pursue different kinds of goals, and they should not be run the same. There's lessons to learn, of course, from either one, but I think there's a little bit of chest pounding on both sides. You know, the corporate think tank types thinking, you know, oh, we could fix the military, and then folks getting out of the military and thinking, well, these peasant civilians, I'm so wise with my military experience. No, there are a lot of incompatibilities about how both organizations run. But this particular case, this is something we should do. And it's fine. You know, I think for us to shoot higher is correct because there are so many inefficiencies in government that we are likely to fall short. And the only reason that we have increased the fleet size at all is because we've been consistently imposing pressure to go higher. The question, it's funny, the question you asked, hey, what are the different kinds of factors and area for reform? I am the critic, not the man in the arena. There are so many things that I do not understand about how this huge organization that I love works in the 10-plus years I've been in the Navy, right? The Navy is always a mystery. It's always new discoveries. It's huge. My concern's not in this article what those factors are, and those factors can change. Right now we're looking at pressures because we have issues with CG modernization. We have issues with LCS now, which we will absolutely solve come hell or high water, damn it. and, you know, another year, it could be, you know, 20 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Like LCS, we do a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, but if you are a fleet that is budget constrained with massive amounts of money going into a land war, building a multi-mission ship that can cover multiple capabilities, can be modified quickly, is not an unwise decision, because if you suddenly need to surge ASW capability, or there is a massive change in the way that mine warfare technology is available, either on the defensive side or on the mine layers side, then yeah, hey, throw some new Connex box, kick that old stuff into the trash and bring a new Connex box. Let's get her done. That makes a lot of sense during that era, and we are now seeing those mistakes. So I don't even know if it's one problem. It's just we're a huge government organization in a, you know, offensive-defensive cycle as people try to fight for new capabilities. There's so many inefficiencies, institutional, with our adversaries, with just basic engineering, things that we discover on ships. The important part is that we recognize that there is a constant, consistent, downward trend that is pushing against every shipbuilding plan that we have, and that the only reason we haven't absolutely collapsed in on ourselves is because we have endeavored to do better. And that can be part of our narrative. If a congressman wanted to start hitting us in the gut about, you know, how come you never meet your shipbuilding plans, we with, you know, no embarrassment can just note that this is the process, right? We have to shoot higher so that we can meet these lower goals. And that's just the nature, I think, of our business. No plan survives contact with the enemy. And for us, there are a lot of internal enemies from, you know, just not on purpose, just the nature of bureaucracy, and real life external enemies that we don't have a choice in what they develop and how they operate. So I have my thoughts on advocacy generally from the Navy on some of the issues that I think we have when it comes to pursuing some of the mission packages and buying stuff that works from Europe. We've seen this with Constellation, right? We were able to fix a lot of these inefficiencies when it came to design and contracting because we were in that moment of panic, and we figured it out. We can do that again, whatever the challenge happens to be, whatever the year happens to be, but we're looking over 20 years. We're looking all the way back to the QDR. You know, the Navy hasn't been over 300 ships since 2003. There's no way to say, and it would be silly to try to project the same frictions year on year all the time. They always change, and that's the problem. You fix one thing, something else falls apart. So I wouldn't be so arrogant as to imagine. I have the ideas, the silver bullet. It's a whole group effort. And that's, I know folks are trying to do that, and I know that the fiscal year 23 shipbuilding plan is part of that effort, right? And the focus on readiness and weapon systems, that is somebody's wise decision to say, hey, man, I don't see the factors lining up here. Where can we use these margins in our budget to get the best impact? And that risk mitigation strategy is right, but of course, there are more problems than just that, and I think that's where everyone's anxiety about the shipbuilding plan comes in. Like, we're running out of time. There's no, we can't just do one solution. We got a lot of stuff that we got to get done, And you know, we're not looking for OCO or anything like that. But it's time to start acting like this is an emergency and applying that effort across the board. And of course, that's a general BS answer from the dude whose job is not to solve this problem. And to all of you listening who are part of that and shaking your fist at me, hey, man, I recognize it. Okay, there's a lot of stuff that I don't know, that I don't understand, and I'm always open to learning about. But, hey, from my cheap seats out here in you know, post-department head LCS land, that's just the way it looks to me.
Well, I'll make excuses for the I look back at the last 40 years because that's when the tanker wars started. You know, we've been involved in a lot of stuff in the last 40 years. In the last 20 years especially, we spent a lot of money on war efforts. Some of that was contingency money, some of which was not used for contingency necessarily. But, you know, yeah, it's been a lean time for the Navy. The Navy hasn't been blowing its own horn the way it should have been. We're also constrained somewhat by the idea that every service gets a third of the defense pie, and we need a very strong advocate from the CNO's office and our Congress people to find some way around that mess of one third, and whatever we have left over, we'll toss a bone to the Coast Guard among the services, and fund, you know, somebody. I'll go along with you. This is where we need to say, what do we need to do what we need to do? And you know, you want a business plan, you don't write a business plan unless you have a goal in mind. In the old days, we wrote the mission, vision, value statements and all that stuff. Well, what's the mission? You know, if the mission is to be able to carry the war across the Pacific Ocean, assuming that, or any ocean for that matter, you're going to have forces to be able to do that. You got to be able to provide the force to sustain that force, and so you've got sustainment issues, you've got shipyard issues, we've allowed so many things to disappear in our peace effort that, yeah, it's a big effort, and it really does need a lot of really loud voices, and some of which we've been talking about on this show for a number of years now, to go back and look at, and I'm certain you've been talking about it at SIMSEC, to go back and say, okay, where are we going to spend our money? What are the goals? I'm sorry, Army, to go along with Blake Hertzinger, you know, Army, we need to cut you a little bit, a lot. To so we can build up our Navy. So, if we ever needed to, in a land war in Asia, God forbid again, then we're going to have to get you there somehow, and the Air Force isn't big enough to carry, doesn't have any things that can carry all the M1 tanks or whatever the next beast you want to fight armor wars with across the ocean. We're going to have to use ships, and ships have to be protected and all that stuff. And that is, I think, behind all the stuff you wrote, behind that is, we need a consistent mission statement from the boss at the top of the Navy and at the head of the country that the Navy is really important. We have to have it to do things, and I don't see that popping up the way it should be popping up. I mean, maybe I missed it, and we're left with, and I'm no disrespect to Representative Gloria or the other people who are pushing this, you know, a single congressman or a couple of congressmen, not enough. We need senators. We need much higher voices in the administration to say we really need a strong Navy. And we'll spend money, as we've already found out, we'll spend money on the most frivolous things. And the fraud, waste, and abuse alone from the COVID-19 stuff would be enough to fund the Navy for the next, you know, I mean, we could build a ton of ships with that fraud, waste, and abuse money, except you can never get it back. So I get a little frustrated with this, and it's like your position on the LCS, by gosh, we'll fix it. And I look at the business concept of sunk cost. Is the LCS one of those sunk cost things where we have to say, yeah, we're going to keep them until we get the Constellations, but after that, they're gone because they're just too expensive to maintain. And if that's the argument we're making for the cruisers, the ones we're going to take down, then we have to, in my view again, is that we have to find some substitute. And, you know, I saw that in response to your article that Barney Rubble came up with, you know, let's get those merchant hulls, let's arm the heck out of them, put them out in the water, and use those, you know, maybe the unmanned force. But let's get going and quit clowning around with it. Now, so let's talk a little bit about that. You know, the ship numbers the Navy's coming up with include all these unknown classes of surface warships that are not manned. You know, does that make sense? And can we use those in conjunction as the wingman concept, like the Air Force wants to do with some of their unmanned aircraft?
One comment on the strategy. Yeah, we'll mix it up. We'll pull some out of it. One comment on the consistent strategy that I'm in the witty pipeline for mine warfare, and I love it. It is not a warfare area that I was familiar with. You know, just involved with the mission package testing for LCS, and it was an incredible opportunity to learn new things. And you do so much staff planning because mine warfare is very slow, and it is a meticulous application of, you know, effort to resources and shuffling those all around to be as efficient as you can, because everybody else is moving at a million miles an hour and you don't. And so you need to maximize your impact while all that stuff is going on around you. So I didn't think anything of there being three COAs, because in staff planning, you're always throwing, hey, boss, here's three COAs. We're going to war game it out. Hey, we'll see what you want. What do you think about that? And so I didn't think anything of it. But once we get up to Congress, I'm of the mind that should have already been done. If we have a strategy, if we have a sound concept of what we need to do and how we need to approach it, there should be a plan. And if we go up to the boss and they say, hey, your plan sucks, then we've got some stuff in the back pocket. I'm a giant, like I've said multiple times, you know, data nerd. And I love there being three COAs. But then I kind of take a step back and say, yeah, but is that the right forum to put three? Does the three COAs mean we're maybe adrift here and we don't know? Because we should need one of these. One of these are needed. And we have three COAs. We have three different strategy documents. A USNI article by Midshipman Tierney. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He kind of comes to the Navy's defense in April's proceedings and say, no, man, we do have a strategy. Check out these documents. Humbly submit, if we've got our strategy spread across multiple large documents and it can't be concisely communicated, we're doing something wrong. People shouldn't have to work to figure it out what it is that we're doing. It's our job to do that work for them. And I think that's part of where we're falling short, is we make all these jokes about, you know, the Twitter feeds, the PAOs, and all the staff speak that they're pumping out. But this is something we struggle with as an institution, from acronyms to using weird language. My wife hits me on this all the time. She's like, why are you talking to me like that? I'm like, I'm not talking to you like that. I just speak a weird language where I say things like execute randomly. We're trying to get stuff done in the house and people are all confused. And that's why when I write, I take these pieces out and I ship them out to my family, because they're the ones I want to be able to communicate to, not just inside the house. And now I have lost track of the rest of the question, and so I come back to you to ask, what was the other thing you wanted to say, now that I've fully distracted myself with that conversation?
Well, I was talking about sunk costs and whether we need to...
Right,
to...
right.
Yeah.
I'm back on board. I had something for you there. So LCS is not a wash. I know there's people in the audience, especially your audience, that don't believe me, but I'm in the independence variant guy. And boy, we just took a hit recently with the structural problems. But, you know, the PCs have had structural problems before. Oliver Hazard Perry had structural issues with the 76 mounted way up high and shooting port and starboard, structural issues across that upper deck. We'll figure that out. It's not the end of the world. The Navy said, you know, nobody's in danger from this, but, you know, we're not in a war right now. So why would we drive these things around in a way that's irresponsible, putting extra stress on them, right? We said that readiness is important, and part of readiness is not breaking stuff or putting undue stress on things for no reason. We'll figure this structural issue out, and we'll move forward smartly. Independence variant, which is what I'm familiar with, has, in the words of Step Brothers, so much room for activities. It is a huge mission bag that has a little warship welded onto the front of it. It is impossible for us not to figure out something to do with this ship. Folks say, oh, what are we going to do with LCS and blah, blah, blah. Man, what do you want to do with it? I have so much room in this place. I've got a massive flight deck. I've got a motivated crew. I've got specialists on board. We can make things happen, and we do that all the time during testing. We'll bring a reefer on board if we need some more food for people. We'll bring living modules on board, bring some extra folks. There is space. We're running out of time, but LCS has your space. And we are the margin for all these different missions. The mine warfare is you know, my latest passion as I develop as a professional. We haven't done mine warfare right since, you know, the Peloponnesian War. You look back 4,000 years and the Athenians just getting stomped in the Great Harbor, spending billions of dollars. I'm unsure how much a talent, whether they meant, you know, 10,000 talents in money or weight, because it meant the same thing back there, but they spent all this money on one ship just to pull wooden posts out of the ground that the Syracusans would just put back into the water. You know, mine warfare is a pain in the butt. And we have aging equipment that, God bless the folks down in Panama City, but now that they have become the OEMs and the corporations have turned back over the contracts because the systems have that limited profit margin, you know, you got guys in sheds down in Florida doing crazy stuff to make that equipment better than it ever was before. So there, you know, I see a lot of positive movement, but we still need platforms. And folks that think we're going to take these big honking amphibious assault ships and all that they can do and put them real close to a minefield inside of an enemy weapons engagement zone, like, so, my guy, that sounds like a lot of stuff that you're putting near a lot of things that can kill it. And LCS has that ability. It has a lower profile. It has all the mission space, and we're not taking effectively what is, in some cases, an aircraft carrier and putting it next to, you know, not the super carrier, but what we've turned into, these flat tops we've turned into to aircraft carriers, and put it right next to a place where there's a bunch of mines. Because here's the thing, you know, just to nerd out about mine warfare. Mine warfare is a bunch of exacting math that is based on somebody's guess on another guess on another guess. It's a science of arts. And so you say, hey, I think the mine threat area is over here. Boy, I hope you're right, my guy, because maybe you're not. And I'm not going to saddle up several hundred dudes in an amphib with all this critical equipment right next to what I may have gotten wrong, because that's not a guarantee. You know, you've still got so many risks involved there. And we've got the Mark 18 Mod 1, which is amazing, the mine hunting UUV. They've got the AMNS, the airborne mine neutralization system, which is like a mine terminator. I love that thing. We've had a lot of failed technologies, but we've had some great success. And if we orient those technologies correctly, I have got for you a fast-moving, flexible warship that can carry that stuff for you. And, you know, in the initial stages of conflict, when suddenly people are less concerned about ordnance safety, you've got opportunities to, you know, stack an LCS deep with NSM and mines and things like that and drive around real fast in places we don't want the adversary to go. Lots of opportunities. So much room for activities. Just we got to get to that stage where we are open-eyed, open-minded, and ready to grab onto that stuff. Because I'll tell you, the crews are ready. People love the amount of training. I'd say in my entire time in the Navy, LCS training pipeline was the most effective and most rewarding I've had, bar none. Love department head school. You know, the TAO stuff is great. But when it comes to really knuckling down, that OOD school for LCS is fantastic. Nothing beats it. And you've got these young JOs who, before they even get to the ship, they go through that school, and they're ready. And it's small teams. You know, we've got first class to senior chiefs out there with JOD letters on the bridge, and it's a dynamic environment because where other ships, you've got different watch stations broken down throughout the ship. You've got the EAO, the TAO, the OOD, and the JOD all in the same room on the Independence variant. And that just changes the way that you approach problems. It changes the way that you think, and not just on watch, but in general, as you approach the challenges that we have ahead. And you have a lot of motivated folks, and it's not just a matter of, hey, does the LCS as a platform have capabilities for me, but does the LCS culture and mentality have opportunities for me? The answer is yes. Those are the guys that you want in the weird places, in the littorals, in the archipelagos, in shallow water, trying to make weird calls, working with Marines, whose strategy is by far the best of any service right now. Those are the folks that I want mixing it up, and I think those are the folks that are going to make a difference. So there's hope. Don't worry, guys. We got it. Everything's fine.
There's always hope. You know, I liked your comment a bit ago, whether you're talking about a mine or a cruise missile or anti-ship cruise missile or a collision with a merchant ship, that there's a danger in doing the, you know, big but very efficient ship where you're one hit away from being unable to accomplish your mission because you put so much into one big platform. And numbers matter. And you know, as you pointed out in the article, it's funny. The 355 is actually the law that we don't seem to want to violate. And the out years are always where the funny stuff happens. And we've told everybody, sure, we'll obey the law in 2041 for 355. And there are two things I wanted you to flesh out for the listeners, because the numbers are just plain scary, is we've seen the last few years people talk about when the window of greatest vulnerability for China, and generally speaking, the pessimist will draw that opening between 24 and 27 and then move it for about 5 or 6 years to the right from there. And yet that, you know, well before 2041. A couple things I wanted to talk about. One, okay, let's say that we do magically reach 355 at 2041. Where will the Chinese Navy be at that time? And let's talk about what is more realistic going to happen, which is the years closest to us, specifically 2022 to 2032. There is a 10-year bathtub of depressing numbers. Talk a little bit about how that impacts should we find ourselves being asked to go do things on the other side of the Pacific.
So digging into these numbers, right, a criticism that I've, you know, I receive, I understand, is, hey, man, why are you concentrating on these shipbuilding numbers? Look at our tonnage. Look at our VLS cells. Hey, we're awesome. Do not disagree. Listen, Aegis guys out there, you're amazing. You know so many more things than me, humble PC frigate LCS guy, knows. I got it. And that tonnage, we're pointing to a point of pride. Like, hey, our ships are big, chonking beasts, and we're going to smash everybody that opposes us. I get that vibe, right? We're the United States Navy. That's what we're going to do. We have more effective NCOs. We have amazing technology. Got motivated people. Everybody's not afraid of being blackbagged by a random commissar in the ship, and we can talk in public about all these concepts in the Navy. We can have these discussions. We can build that professional capability in a way that they may be afraid to. But what it also means is when you have a much smaller number of ships and greater tonnage, that means the margins of your failure, there's more single points of failure there. I'm using the term wrong, but I think the point is generally sound, is that you're likely to lose a chunk of that tonnage far more quickly. And as a guy on his way to Minetown, that really resonates with me, right? You drive a whole bunch of ships. You think about it. Here's the threat, the simple initial threat of a conflict with an adversary. Let's compare it to a minefield, right? You have a certain amount, a certain chance of a number of ships getting through to the other side and winning the battle. And this conceptual, very conceptual minefield that represents the overall risk of a conflict. You have a whole bunch of ships going through a minefield. The one that's at the end, the ones that are at the end, have a much lower risk of being sunk or being damaged than the ones at the front. The fewer ships that go through, the higher that risk is for the guy at the very end. And so we should kind of look at it like that. Like, yeah, absolutely, we've got the technology, we've got the tonnage, we've got the motivation, but we lose one guy. Whereas they lose one guy, it's a lot different. And when you combine with that the China's largest aircraft carrier, which is China itself, the almost continent-sized nation, we should be humbled by this challenge. You'd mentioned at the top end of the show, Ukraine. A lot of folks walk away from this conflict thinking, you know, the Chinese are using reskinned weapons from Russia. Heck yeah, they're going to be it's going to be a trash party when we go out there. I worry that that is us being the Russians. The lesson from Ukraine is, you know, don't assume away adversary capability. And the Russians did that. They just assumed that they're going to march in, and everything's going to be great, and we're going to take Kiev. And, you know, everybody now that's a big Russia fan is like, oh, it was a feint. It was a feint for a feint. And then a feint of a feint, and we're just throwing full battalions and getting them chewed up and turning into feints. No, this was hubris. And hubris is the enemy. We should not assume away adversary capability. And they have more numbers. They have less tonnage. They have less VLS cells. But it's not just Navy on Navy. And this is a criticism, another criticism that I've received is, and it's well met. I absolutely agree. Hey, man, we're not going to fight Navy on Navy. And my obsession with the Navy, because I am a naval officer and this is what I love talking about, Navy makes it seem like I think we got to go ship on ship, bop, 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 have one DDG for every random ship that they put to sea. Absolutely not. That is not the way that a conflict would be fought. And that is a pipe dream that we could have a Navy that large with our limitations in budget and limitations in yards. But that doesn't mean the numbers are right. You know, we are still the mobile, survivable force that's not going to be pounded into dust by shore-based rocket artillery and all the assorted weapons that the adversary has. We have all sorts of capabilities just by the nature of being a Navy that others do not and others will rely upon. And something just to dig into others relying on us is there are good things in, you know, the fiscal year 23 shipbuilding plan. It's not just a trash bag, right? I'm talking about the parts that I'm concerned of in my article. But, you know, buried in that, we talked about earlier, is the risk mitigation strategy. I think that's right. You know, I think these DDG COs and these cruiser COs, when they get out there, they want these good weapon systems. You know, that doesn't show up in the ship numbers, but that's the right answer. Another one of the right answers is if we compare the shipbuilding plan to 2017, and 2017 is like a weird everything's kind of projecting up, and then just randomly in 2017, everything drops a little bit. So in order to not seem like I'm unfairly beating on this plan, I chose that as the, you know, dig-in comparison point for fiscal year 23. Our plan for fiscal year 23 exceeds by its end, 2031, where everything kind of splits off. It has 15 more logistics and support craft than the 2017 plan. Someone looked in there and realized, hey, man, our logistics tail is taking a beating. We need to improve these margins, right? People are making the right decisions in here. It's not an issue of the right wording. It's an issue of scale, not of the exact content of how we're skewing these numbers. And the plan compared to 2015 has a few more SSNs in it. Absolutely. Those are heavy hitters. Those are going to do a lot. Those are going to do God's work out in Westpac. So somebody's tweaking these numbers, and they're not doing it. We do these criticisms, but it's not – there is so much thought that's put into here. And, you know, my heart goes out. I bless these guys for doing God's work. They're trying to do it in a constrained environment and squeeze every efficiency that they can. I keep wanting to say reticle. That's not the word. That is so weird. This is terrible. This is, you know, live format's terrible. I need to be able to go back and edit everything so that I don't say something dumb and I can just, like, make it disappear. Like I used to with C-Control, where I could sound incredibly incompetent and just edit all those parts out. But I think, you know, aperture. Boom. There we go. I was pausing for time. That's it. We got to open that aperture and really kind of improve these plans and our advocacy for them.
I think that's – thank you for that, Matt. And I want to thank you for coming on today. I'm afraid we're taking up an hour of your time.
We need to
bring you back for the two hour special.
Man, I was afraid I had no content. I was like, oh man, what am I going to talk about for a full hour? I don't know.
I knew that would never be a problem, Matt, knowing you.
Yeah, but I wanted to make sure that we get a chance for you to plug whatever you're working on next, and so we can and tell people where to find your stuff and where they can find out about the enthusiastic, but brought down to earth by his family readers, Matt.
Well, if you're looking for my existential screams into the professional void when it comes to shipbuilding numbers, you can just find me on Twitter, living in my own personal hell, @Navy_Hipple. And then if you're looking for my professional writing, it's scattered all over the place, but recently I've been back to, Club Simsek, and I've probably got one or two more articles coming out, unless my sons do something incredibly stupid that requires me to tend to their repairs or the repairs of my home. So, you know, no particular timelines on that, but, just generally speaking, not plugging myself, but for any of the listeners out there, get out there and write. You know, if you think I'm full of crap and my points are bad and I just don't get it and I'm advocating for a bad strategy or I don't know the right perspective, hey, SimSec is out there for you. You can write, and as long as it's competent and professional and not attacking anybody, it's a perfect venue for you to vent your informed perspective. And that's what we're here for. You know, I'm not particularly committed I am committed because I think they're informed, the positions I have, but I am open to change. I can be convinced that, hey, man, the shipbuilding numbers are not what you should worry about. You should worry about Humpty Scrunch, this and that. You know, I think there's a lot of cores of truth in the folks that are criticizing my points. I want to see those. I want to read those. I want to, you know, make my point better. I want to improve my perspective and just generally be a good advocate for the profession and for, what we do in the Navy.
Well, Matthew, that is great stuff. And once again, it's been a pleasure catching up with you and spending an hour. And I know you've got got the misses and the boys that have behaved themselves the last hour, but you probably need to go take care of some business.
That's
there.
Weird. That's weird. I thought they were going to try to break into here. I was waiting for them to start screaming, Bobby, Bobby, banging on the door.
You're a good father and husband, man. You brought them up right, and they're just showing off for you, so it's good.
I am not. I am a middling dad and an irritating husband, as my Twitter bio says. So I'm sticking to that one. that's what I am.
Well, we wouldn't have it any other way, and we look forward to another opportunity to talk to you down the road. And, hey, have a great summer.
Yeah, we need to get you back to talk about mine warfare some more, because that is a subject near and dear to my heart, and I think it's one of those greatly underappreciated but absolutely necessary things to talk about. Anyway, now is not the time, though, Matt, so we'll let you go, and thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure, gentlemen.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrat. And until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Piccadilly, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Piccadilly, to the sweetest girl I know. Farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Is it safe to come out now?